Hello, I'm Dr. Barry Holzer.
And I'm Chani Holzer.
And we're here today with another edition of Parent is a Verb. Thank you for tuning in on OUradio.org. Our topic today is, when does my child need professional treatment?
Scary topic. Very scary topic. Probably much scarier than stitches, broken bones, severe infections. I think this is probably a parent's biggest fear.
All kids have emotional ups and downs, have turmoil at some point, get upset, get sad, get nervous. But when does it reach the point that I say, I really should talk to somebody about this. I really need professional help.
By the way, it doesn't mean that your child is going to necessarily be seeking professional help, although that might be true also. Very often it's about, well, maybe this is more than I'm used to dealing with, and maybe this is more than I can deal with, or I have the capacity or the knowledge or the capability of dealing with, and maybe I need to go and speak to someone who is an objective professional in this area.
In fact, let me tell you a little vignette, because I think this is a very apropos topic, especially in the Orthodox community. Years ago, I was director of a clinic that doesn't exist anymore called Marpe, which is operated out of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And the director of psychiatry at the time was a very Jewishly identified, but not religious Jew, from Europe, who called in and wanted to meet with me and wanted to hear about what we're doing, was really very interested. And he asked me a simple question. He says, what's the difference between the people who come to your clinic and people who come to any other clinic in our system? And my answer to him right off the bat, I don't know how he thought of this, was 6 years. And he says, what do you mean? I says, they come into me on average about 6 years later than they come into any other clinic. And I think this is a big issue in the Orthodox community, mostly driven by the shidduch worry that parents have.
Right, because if your child has problems, clearly if any child has problems, then it'll probably ruin the, anyone knows about these problems, no matter what they are, clearly it's going to ruin the marital prospects for any other sibling in the family. So that could be from toilet training to not having attended the same school for 12 years, needing to have, gone from school to school.
I think the fear of having a child, quote unquote, labeled is so great that I say people, they often don't realize, I said, if your kid is having problems at school or is fighting with other kids, it's pretty obvious to everybody that there's a problem. You can't really hide this.
Right, they're wearing a label already. It just may not be an appropriate label, but people know something's up, and there is some sort of label out there in the common community.
So that in school, they've certainly labeled your kid already, and not getting help in treating the problem isn't going to unlabel your kid, or as in getting help isn't going to label them. It's there already. So that I think the first issue we have to deal with is really overcoming the stigma. We've talked about this in, Nefesh, the Orthodox Jewish Mental Health Conferences, on numerous occasions, and it's really one of the biggest issues we deal with as a barrier to treatment. So I think that's the first thing to address is we put our children first.
I mean, I guess I want to tell another story. When I started graduate school back in the early 1980s, I really didn't know many people who were in therapy because my community was primarily Orthodox, and I didn't know many therapists. And I remember getting to the Hunter College School of Social Work for graduate school and being in the cafeteria on probably the first week of classes and sitting with fellow classmates, kind of getting to know people and feeling them out. And I remember being totally thunderstruck and having my mind blown wide open when people who I just barely met, didn't even know, couldn't even remember their first names at that point, were quoting their therapists. So back in the early 1980s, okay, yes, this is a self-selected community. These were people who were going to social work school. So maybe they were more mental health oriented to begin with, but anywhere in the world in the early 1980s, seeing a therapist was like, you know, a good thing. It was like, oh, it was like something you could take pride in, not something you needed to be embarrassed about.
This issue and this stigma, unfortunately, still exists in our community. So therefore, I think this question becomes so much more important because we're already coming from a bias of avoiding therapy.
And why do people avoid therapy, Dr. Holzer? What is this, besides the shidduch stigma, what's the other stigma?
The fear of the unknown.
Fear of the unknown, and from what I remember before I've trained as a therapist and been in this world of therapy for so many years, people who go to therapists are clearly crazy people who are banging their heads up against the wall and can't tell their right from their left. They're nuts.
Right. The idea that you only go to therapy if you're crazy, and I explain to people all the time, I say, you know, if people come to my office so nervous, I say, explain to them. So you understand, the people who come to my office and get help, I have tremendous respect for. And thank God, you know, this concept that people go to psychiatrists never get better is really patently false. People go to psychiatrists, almost all get better. You know, there's a very small population of chronically mentally ill. The great majority of people really improve dramatically. And so the idea of people going to therapists, the people who come are the ones who look very totally normal. You don't know that they have a problem. It's the people who don't go for therapy, who I see in shul, who I can tell you really could use some help and clearly are not getting it. Those are the people who really have the problems. And we have to be mature enough to recognize that if I treat a problem, I can learn to manage it and things will improve.
Right. If I ignore the problem, chances are it's not going to get better and it could get more entrenched and much more difficult to treat in the long run.
Right. And as I just yesterday was seeing a couple with their very hyperactive 11-year-old boy, and they asked me, like, you know, well, if we don't give him medicine, what's going to happen? I said, well, there's a ton of research, and it shows very clearly. Kids with hyperactivity who get treated look pretty much like normal kids. And kids with hyperactivity who don't get treated are at higher risk for alcohol abuse, substance abuse, going off the derech, getting into trouble with the law, having problems with relationships, having problems with jobs, and on we go. But if you treat them, they really do very well. So that, you know, we're really just advocating taking care of your kids properly. And just like you have to know when do I call my pediatrician for my child, it's important for parents to know when do I call a mental health professional for my child.
What are some of those guidelines?
So I think the first one is, you know, when the school comes and tells you your kid has really having a problem, we're having a problem with him keeping him in the classroom, his behavior's unmanageable, he's disrupting the classroom, whatever that might be, okay? The response is not, oh, the school's really bad, I'll just put him in a different school, okay? And I've seen kids who've been through 3 or 4 different schools by the time they were in 5th grade.
Yes, unfortunately.
And nothing improved. Because, as my wife always liked to say, wherever you go,
there you are.
And so they take their problems with them. So that, yes, you know, if your child's having a particular issue with a particular kid at school, then it may not be a case where they really need professional guidance, though you might decide to talk to somebody of how to address the issue and how to deal with it. But if the school's saying, you know, if you've heard it before and you're hearing it again, that he's hard to manage and he's disruptive and he's too loud and he's not getting along and so forth and he's not learning, he's not doing his work, then you really should at least go for a consultation.
And that, you know, that's the easy one. When the school tells you that it has to happen, that's easy because then it's clearly identified for you. Also, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to run to the mental health professional with your child. Very often, it can just be a consultation.
And I'll have people sometimes call me up where they just want to come in and talk about what's going on with their kid to discuss, you know, how they should proceed or what they need to do.
And, you know, I guess also it's not my bias. It's my experience that has educated me and taught me that the sooner you take care of it, the less severe it will be and the easier it will be to treat and the shorter time it will take for it to resolve.
In terms of addressing the more difficult issues now, how about if the school isn't complaining? What do you have to watch for in your child in order to be concerned enough to consult a professional? And I think there are a number of categories this falls into. The first one are certainly learning problems.
Yes.
If your kid seems to be an average kid and they're doing good, doing average work, it seems to be fine. But if your kid is failing at certain subjects,
not even failing, but is chronically struggling to keep up, that, you know, what the teacher says that the homework should take no more than 20 minutes, and every night it's an hour and a half, and it's not just an hour and a half, it's an hour and a half of struggle and crying and tearing your hair out, and the child being frustrated and angry and feeling very defeated.
And unfortunately, in many yeshivas, they're very happy to just push kids along. And they're not going to be, especially if the kid's a sweet kid and they're trying.
Right.
They're not going to fail the kid.
I always say, it's unfortunate, that kids like that aren't bouncing off the walls or throwing rocks through the windows, because if they were bouncing off the walls and they were throwing rocks through the windows, well, they would get some attention. But if they're just struggling in their own right, then no one's really necessarily paying attention to that.
And so, for example, right? You have the kids with ADD, with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So there are kids who are really restless and impulsive and get into trouble and are disrupting the class. And those kids really get attention. But the kids who are just purely inattentive and they sit there daydreaming most of the day and they're not causing trouble to anybody, nobody complains about those kids. The school doesn't call you about them. The teachers, the parent teachers say, well, he could do better work. He's a little lazy. He has to try harder, but he's a really sweet kid. We really like him. And then we miss the boat.
And very often children like that can make it through elementary school without any real difficulty. They may not be the top of the class, but they may not be the very bottom of the class either. They may just, squeak by. But take a kid like that and put them in high school where there are really many more demands and many more things coming at them simultaneously, and it becomes overwhelming.
Right. And I see this all the time, because depending on how bright the kid is, that's how far he can get in school without really putting in too much effort. And so if the kid's really bright, he might make it through high school. Most kids hit the wall when they hit ninth grade. By then, their self-esteem is shot because they're kids with a 95 capability and an 82 average. And they feel really bad about themselves. They know that they could do better and that they're smarter than the kid sitting next to them who's getting an 88. And then yet they somehow can't do it.
Right.
And they start to believe that they're bad or they're lazy or they're no good. Okay. So if your kid is struggling, you want to address it and find out what's going on.
It could be a learning disability. It could be an attentional issue. It could be a variety of things, but it's something that you really have to kind of catch before it erodes anybody's sense of who they are, their capabilities, or their sense of self-esteem.
And you have to be a real advocate for your child, because not infrequently I've seen where people have gone to a professional. The professional has, uses the tools that they have. They don't figure out the problem. And then it just gets pushed aside. And the problem goes on and on until eventually, years later, they happen upon the right professional who can solve the problem. So that if you get your kid a educational evaluation and they doesn't seem to show much, or you got a psychoed eval from the Board of Ed and they tell you everything's fine, your kid's okay, then if the kid's struggling, you keep moving on.
I always say, especially, for mothers out there, you have to trust your gut and you have to know your kid, and you know your kid better than anybody. So even if the, quote, professional or the school evaluation says one thing and it just doesn't all add up to you, well, don't stop there. Keep going. There's probably another professional or there's someone else out there who will be able to address the problem or the issue correctly.
Unfortunately, I see the results of this frequently, where kids have gone on for years and the parents said, but I took them to somebody in second grade and I tried again in fifth grade, and now they're in seventh and eighth grade, and they're going for the third time, and this is a problem that I can solve for them. And I think what sometimes the professionals, I don't expect every mental health professional to be able to diagnose and figure out every problem. There are a lot of problems I know that I can't figure out. But my job is to make sure that I send them the right place where it can be figured out. So
right.
If a kid needs a neuropsychological testing to pick up a fine, you know, a narrow learning disability that's getting in their way, I want them to, I'll tell them, you need to do this.
But, you know, this isn't so different than a physical ailment where, you know, you go to one doctor and the doctor says surgery is necessary and you're feeling frightened or worried that that may not be the right diagnosis or decision. We all go for second opinions.
Right.
You're not comfortable or something's not adding up correctly for you from the first professional you go to. Well, get a second opinion.
I mean, I just got called today from a mother who I saw her teenage son a couple of months ago. And I told her, the kid doesn't have ADD. I think he has an anxiety disorder. And he possibly could have a learning disability. And she calls me back now because they didn't really follow through with a treatment for the anxiety. But he still has the same problem. She has her belief what it is. And we've really got to go further to identify the issue and what exactly is happening here.
Right. And a lot of, you know, besides the early treatment and the early uncovering of issues that are, you know, not just going to go away by themselves, they're not necessarily going to be quote-unquote outgrown, is really a lot about keeping intact and honoring the child's sense of self, a healthy sense of self and self-esteem, and not letting that wither away because things haven't been addressed and haven't been taken care of.
Certainly, school academic learning issues are, again, those are more identifiable. And I think we're going from the easiest to then the somewhat more difficult. How about social problems? What if your kid is socially isolated? They stay to themselves. They don't participate in other things.
They're not playing at recess. They're kind of hanging alone on the side. They don't really seem to have a playmate ever over to the house, or they're not being invited over to anyone else's house.
Right. So, you know, sometimes some kids really just more comfortable, you know, at times spending time by themselves. Some kids are very good at it. They really like to read, and some kids are more bookworms. They can spend Shabbos afternoon with a book and really enjoy themselves. And I remember with one of our kids, you know, in eighth grade, we're saying, how come you don't go with friends more on Shabbos? How come you spend so much time at home? And by 10th or 11th grade, we're saying, how come we never see this kid? He's never home anymore.
Right. So some kids do go through phases, but I think in general what you want to look for are patterns.
Right.
You know, what's the pattern here?
So if your child has friends, and when they're with their friends, they seem to interact appropriately, and they seem to be doing okay. And when they're home by themselves, they're not complaining chronically of being bored, and they don't seem sad, and they don't seem overly uncomfortable, then you may say, they're going through a phase, this might be fine. But if they really avoid social situations, if they don't want to go to the bar mitzvah, the bat mitzvah, or the friend invites them over and they'll almost never go to play.
And they also seem somewhat bothered by it.
Right.
They feel like they would like to. Some kids don't go, but they almost would love to be able to go, but can't seem to allow themselves to go and be in that situation.
Right. So if recognize that they're sort of in pain about it, or they're torn over it, then you really have to look at, you know, why are they not participating, especially if this is a noticeable change in their behavior. If they were more social and now they're starting to isolate themselves more, starting to withdraw.
Right. I mean, I think also one of the things to look for that, you know, I think some schools are really trying to address is the bullying factor. Is there a reason that maybe your child is staying home, or maybe it's an external issue? Maybe there's a bully in school, and bullies are both genders. There are female bullies and male bullies alike, unfortunately.
Yes. And sometimes it's not so obvious. Your kid doesn't have to go home with a black eye or
torn clothing.
Right. Or a bloodied mouth, with a fat lip to have been bullied.
The whole bullying issue. Bullies are extremely crafty at being able to do their bullying when nobody else is watching.
And very often the bullying is just verbal. And so if a kid is being ostracized because of verbal bullying, they may not be obvious, and they may be embarrassed by it and not want to tell you about it. So there are a lot of possibilities. Some kids are socially isolated because they develop more social anxiety. And they have, they're very nervous about what's going to happen when they're with the other kids. Are they going to look stupid? Are they going to say the wrong thing? And they worry tremendously about the social, they're being social and they're being interactive.
And they're so worried and so preoccupied with the worry that it doesn't allow them to put themselves in the situations that are going to make them so anxious.
Right. So that because of their anxiety about the social situations, they really avoid it. Sometimes we'll see kids where they have a problem managing their social skills are limited. And so they may have been fine in first, second grade, or even third, but now in fifth or sixth grade, where the social expectations are greater and you have to sort of be more socially adept and astute, their social skills are a bit limited. And they're not sure how to handle that or what to do about it, and so they just avoid it.
And I think, all of these things, if there's a real noticeable change in behavior or approaching certain situations, then that's a red flag.
Yes.
That's a time, your first line of action is really to talk to your child about it.
Right.
And to ask all those open-ended questions. I noticed this. What do you think? What's going on, sweetheart? Is something bothering you? Is something making you uncomfortable? Is something making you unhappy? And you don't have to ask all those questions at once, like a firing squad. You can ask those questions, once you're on a grocery run, you try to initiate conversation, and, you're folding the laundry together, you ask, another question. You just try to kind of piece the pieces of the puzzle together to make the big picture.
I think what a key element that I want parents to remember from this is when there's a noticeable change in behavior, you have to ask, why is this happening? And sometimes there might be reasonable explanations, and it might be a passing phase, or it might be a specific situation they're avoiding. They may not be going to a specific place or specific person because they don't get along with them, they had a problem, whatever it might be. But noticing the change is really important. Another example of sometimes where kids avoid situations is kids who can't separate. And it's interesting, separation anxiety really starts at a very young age and usually dissipates by 2.5, maybe 3 years old. And a 2.5-year-old really can't go to playgroup, usually the answer is give a few more months and see how they do. Because till the age of about 2.5 or so, it's pretty normal to kids to have a hard time separating. Unless they've been in by a babysitter, in this gone or in some sort of daycare since they're really very young, where they see it as normal, they could really have a hard time with that. But when you have older kids, and it's interesting because it often develops, it goes away, and then it comes back at the age, let's say, of 12 or 13, right. And you have kids who can't do a sleepover, can't go to camp, or even the most severe forms, I'll have kids at almost any age who won't go to school. I was just dealing with a case like that today where this kid hasn't really been in regular class in pretty much a year, and that requires professional help and right away. Because, unfortunately, if you don't deal with this basic underlying fear, and the fear in separation anxiety is the fear that something bad is going to happen if I'm not there. So if I'm not with mom, something bad might happen to her.
Right. Is mom going to be okay if I go to school? Is mom going to be okay if I go to camp? Is mom going to be okay if I go to a sleepover?
Right. Or is somebody else in the family, is the house going to be okay? Or am I going to be okay if I'm not with them? So there's some fear about the integrity of self or the family that is created by the separation. And once you overcome this fear, then everything else becomes much easier.
Right, and a lot of the work can be around helping the child understand and think about these things in a different way.
So mild separation anxiety that the kid with a little effort can overcome is not a big deal. And if the kid has a problem the first day or two of school and then they're fine, or the first couple of days of camp, they cry a little bit and then they're okay. Okay.
That's normative. But also, a lot of these things run in families. So if you were the child who really found it very, very painful to be in sleepaway camp, or you were the child who had a really hard time going to sleepovers, well, you know what? Chances are that you're going to have a kid, who's at least one, who's going to look like that.
Right. It's important, though, because I mean, their kids deal with in terms of, let's say, going off to Israel after high school. And they haven't gone to sleepaway camp for years, even though all their friends have, because they it's too uncomfortable for them. They went a few years ago. They had to come back after a few days, and they haven't tried it since. And now they're going off to Israel, and they really want to go. And here they're willing to make the effort, and they're terrified because they're afraid they're going to fall apart. And I would much rather treat this much earlier.
Right. I mean, I was very fortunate to work with a young lady who was in the middle of high school and knew that she had been unsuccessful in separating from going to camp, but also knew that Israel was looming ahead within the next couple of years of her life, and she knew she wanted to be successful at that. So she and her mom were extremely astute at coming in so that we could start working on separation issues in high school, you know, in the middle of high school. And she actually did go to camp very successfully this summer. We did a lot of work about changing, you know, her thinking about separating and what all of that was about for her. And she probably will do very well separating and going on to Israel, even though she will also might feel a little bit more anxious than your average child. She'll be able to navigate that successfully.
Right. So what has been called, let's say, school phobia, or, you know, these other examples of kids' difficulty separating, it's all part of this separation anxiety, which is one of the most common anxiety disorders in children and adolescents. And I guess that's why we're focusing on it a lot. Don't ignore it. Let's treat it. Very often, by the way, the treatment doesn't necessarily have to involve medication. Very often, a good therapist and some behavioral work can really do wonders in overcoming these type of symptoms. And that's true for a lot of things. I mean, anxiety disorders in general, there's a lot of therapy that can really teach you how to manage your anxiety. You can really learn how to understand it, how to handle it, how to manage it better. That's a very important part of the treatment. And I think this learning those skills really helps kids manage anxiety better in the future than if they never had to deal with it before.
And it allows them to feel very successful and very in charge of themselves, as opposed to feeling overwhelmed.
Another issue that often, I think, gets ignored, and I think is very important, is a kid who starts davening for 2 hours every morning.
Oh, you mean they're not just really having a lot of kavana and, you know, concentration on their praying?
Or they get very overly cautious and careful about some other halacha or some other religious ritual. It's like, you know, every day is cleaning for Pesach. And the typical things, this are like, say, washing their hands constantly. You know, I can't learn because my hands are dirty. I touch this, I touch that. And they go wash their hands very, very frequently. Or sometimes kids will just start hoarding things. And these are part of what we call obsessive compulsive disorder. And it's interesting because the original book on it by Judith Rapoport back in the 1980s, I believe, included a whole section on a religious boy who every time he had a thought believed he took a neder, believed he took a vow, and he had to do whatever the thought was. Mm. And part of her treatment included Hataras Nedarim. That she took him to the, you know, to talk to his rabbis and got rabbis together to say they did this sort of general hatara so that whatever he thought was no longer a neder. Hmm. And it was, you know, incorporated that in the treatment.
That was creative.
Yes. And it's, you know, it's in the bestseller, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing. But these are often very overlooked and very difficult situations that really require a lot of help, and they can be very painful and very disruptive. But very, very frequently, kids will hide them. They're not going to tell you. So, but if you notice, again, if you see a change in behavior, okay, if your kids can't seem to get out of chakras on time and therefore is going late to, you know, to class, if your kid, his hands look red and he seems to be running to wash them too frequently, if your kid's doing any other behavior that seems a bit odd or strange, or he has concerns and that, you know, he seems to talk about more, or he can't get, you know, that seems to come up.
I think change in behavior and patterns.
Right. Then that really requires professional help. And there's wonderful treatment today that really is very effective. But you've got to really do the treatment. You can't just ignore it. Again, these are significant issues.
Right. I think the other ones that, you know, are near and dear to my heart and are painful all at the same time are eating issues, especially with young ladies, although it's not uncommon with young men to have some sort of eating issues. It's very hard in today's day and age to know what healthy and not healthy approaches to eating are, because there's just so much out there and there's so much distortion around eating and eating behaviors, and there's just so much information. But I think, you know, critical things to look for are, you know, girls who, in particular, who once ate normally and healthily, all of a sudden have some sort of, you know, start a diet because they want to lose weight and drop an enormous amount of weight very quickly and can't seem to stop dieting. That's not insignificant. That's a diet that's really gone wrong, that can turn into an eating disorder way too easily. That's something that you need to pay attention to. Well, let's just say that your daughter did have 50 pounds to lose. Okay, but she lost the 50 pounds inside of 2 months. That's a problem.
Right.
Or if she can't stop, if she's suddenly taken up exercising, but and it was great, you know, the first couple of months, you know, she was going to the gym 2-3 times a week, but now she's going to the gym 6 days a week and she can't stop going to the gym. And even when she's home, she can't seem to sit still, and she's jumping rope, you know, every night before she goes to sleep. You've got an issue.
Right. I think what's hard today is that issues with body image have become almost universal. We live in a society where the media puts out a message about body image that is unnatural and unrealistic.
Well, you know, one of my favorite things to say, you know, in terms of talking about the media, the point that I like to make is that if the media has a vested interest in making us all feel bad about our bodies, because otherwise they couldn't sell us stuff. So if they couldn't help us find things wrong with our bodies and the way we look, they wouldn't be able to sell us the product, and that's what they're in the business to do. They're in the business to make money selling the product, advertising the product so that the people who make the products can make the profits. So it's all about money.
Right.
So there's a vested interest in, you know, working on us and making us feel lousy about ourselves. They're not going to make money if we feel good and happy about ourselves. That's just not the way it goes.
Right. So if your 13 or 14-year-old daughter comes home and starts talking about my stomach is too fat and this part of me is no good and that part is complaining about, that might just be time to sit down and reassure and, you know, tell her positive qualities and talk about the issues with the media. And, you know, there are certainly books that you can read if you need help in talking about these issues. But beyond, you know, that, if, you know, all of a sudden they're changing the clothes and they don't want anyone to see what they look like, and they go to sort of wearing, you know, baggy sweatshirts, and you see a real change in the behavior as well, okay, or a real significant change in their eating habits as well, then you have to really talk about at least a consultation to assess the issue.
And in general, in this area, I think it's extremely important to have a home environment where health is stressed, not diet, not fat versus skinny, but just we eat to be healthy, we exercise to be healthy. Our whole approach to life is about good health and balance in our lives.
Right. And even if you have a kid, sometimes it's hard for a mother who has a daughter who's overweight. She'd like her to lose weight. Okay. The stress can't be on, you know, you're going to look good. The stress has to be on really you're going to be healthier. because you don't want to reinforce a negative self-image. That really does not work. And generally, kids who overeat, it's because they feel bad about themselves in the first place. And so sometimes if your kid is just gaining a lot of weight, that might be a reason to really seek professional help, okay? And sometimes just a nutritionist might be a great way to go. But sometimes a therapist is really a way to go, you know, might be suggested, because the underlying reasons that they're eating have to do with how they feel about themselves, and they're not feeling very good. So I think this is a significant issue in our society, and especially from society, going back to the whole shidduch issue, where girls who are overweight have a harder time getting dates. And the way our shidduch system is set up, unfortunately, it's not like boys and girls sort of get to know each other and know their personalities and might be attracted by, because they, you know, the person's sense of humor or other things. It's, you know, the superficial is really what people see first.
Well, packaging is everything, isn't it?
At least in our society. Finally, I think the hardest thing to pick up upon is when kids are depressed. And that's because depressed kids do not look anything like depressed adults. I still remember a teenage girl I had in my office. When I told her and her mother that she was depressed, the mother told me I was crazy, okay, and refused to accept it and refused to accept any treatment. But the bottom line is that thankfully, pre-adolescent kids get depressed rarely. But in adolescence, it's not that rare. But it's much harder to notice because they look okay when they're with their friends. They look okay when they're doing things they enjoy. But when they get home, or they're not around friends, they're not doing anything they like, they're chronically bored. They can't seem to find themselves. They don't know what to do. They're not, then they're not happy.
They're irritable.
Right. And they don't use the term depressed. If you ask them, are you depressed? You said, no. How do you feel? I'm bored. It's a very different sensation for them. And it presents differently. So that with an adult, when they're really depressed, they don't function very well. They have to drag themselves to work. Even if they're functioning, they're going to work, they're not functioning well at work, and they come home, they do nothing. And it's pretty obvious, if you spend some time with them, that they're depressed. Whereas, if your teenager is depressed, and they're with their friends, and they went to the movies, okay, and they're hanging out together, they seem okay during that time. And as soon as they have to be with themselves, they're bored, and they look like they're in pain.
And it's not something that they're necessarily going to grow out of organically by themselves without addressing it.
Teenage depression is a very serious illness with very serious, you know, morbidity and mortality, and it really needs to be addressed, and they need help with it, and they don't know necessarily how to get that help.
And very often, you know, these types of situations, I get parents' calls first. My kid will never come to a therapist, even if I want to bring them. How do I get them to come? So that's usually a good question. That's usually your first baseline of, like, how do I get my kid to come to a therapist?
Now, with pre-adolescents, it's rare, thank goodness, but again, this change in behavior. The kid's not functioning the way he used to. They seem sad. They're not doing well in school. They're socializing less. All these things really can point to a depression. And if you're seeing these things, you don't even have to make the diagnosis, but you do need to get some professional help and figure out what's going on. I think that to sum up for today, if your child's behavior changes, that's a tip-off that there's a problem.
And you know what? As parents, we really don't have to know it all. We just have to be the good observers that we are naturally as parents. We know our kids. We know their behaviors. We know what's normative for them. And we can kind of recognize what might not be normative and what might be different for them. And that's really all that's required.
And if you see that there's a change for the worse and it's not getting better after a week or two, talk to somebody. Get some advice. Ask them, you know, this is what's going on with my kid, what should I do? And if you talk to a professional, they might just advise you on what you can do to help your kid. They might advise some reasoning for you, and then if things aren't improving, then you'll go to the next step. But, you know, there's having a professional that you trust and you can talk to and that you can ask your questions to, really very helpful. Don't be afraid of getting help for your kid. Don't worry about the stigma. You just worry about doing what's best for you and your family and your child. Thank you again for joining us today on Parent is a Verb at OUradio.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email them to parentisaverb, all one word, parentisaverb@ou.org. Thank you and have a good day.